Thank you. I'm Mary Case, University Librarian at University of Illinois at Chicago. And this panel is here this afternoon to talk a little bit about the implementation of OVJS at UIC. And in particular, we wanted to focus on the experience of two of the editors of the OJS journals that we have, Mark Mattani, who is editor of Behavioral and Social Sciences, and Mark is a professor in our School of Social Work at UIC, and then Ed Velasquez, who is editor of First Monday. And they will be spending much of the time of this panel kind of focused on the nitty-gritties of moving and editing a journal in OJS. And they will be followed by Nancy John, who was our digital publishing librarian in the library, who has actually worked to make this all happen. And she will talk more about the details and the relationship with our computer center that allowed all of this to happen. I'm going to start very briefly, I hope, and run through what I think we've actually heard a lot about over the last day, why libraries are involved in this at all, and what sort of prompted us to get involved in electronic publishing. And I'll talk very, very briefly about these three things. One is certainly the initial adoption of technology by libraries and our interest once the internet and the web came along to certainly make the information we had available electronically. Then to address the larger issues in scholarly communication, and then I think to help ourselves prepare for emerging forms of new research and scholarship. Libraries were among the first to actually experiment when the internet came out, and we did Gophers and Mosaic, and when the web came, we're there to help create websites that would make our own information available. UIC was, again, an early experimenter in this area and actually worked with communities within the Chicago area, including the Chicago Public Library, in helping to design and host and set up their first website. And actually working for the U.S. Department of State in creating their first web presence and then serving as an archive for that over the years. UIC also became a publisher early on, hosting the AIDS Book Review Journal, which was edited by one of our faculty members in the library, and then again taking on the electronic publishing of First Monday in the late 1990s. Moving to the broader scholarly communication issues, I think these are all very, very familiar to those in the audience. That whole circle of gifts that we call the scholarly communication cycle and the underlying economic vein, certainly with the money that was pumped into the sciences after World War II and Sputnik, these scholarly societies, as we actually heard about this morning, really didn't have the wherewithal to move in and to take on all the additional publishing and new journals that were being created as a result of the grant fundings and federal money, certainly within the U.S. at any rate. And this whole notion of free content and free reviewers was a very lucrative one for the commercial sector to come in and take a look at. And, of course, that exclusive copyright, which was kind of a critical piece to all of this. At any rate, what we know has resulted is this global publishing industry that's dominated by the commercial sector, and we've seen various cuts of that from RAIM's data this morning as well, and certainly dominated by a few large key players and then that long tail of a lot of individual publishers. Libraries created Spark about 10 years ago also, as we heard, as an attempt to try to have some counteraction against this, introducing new journals. We hoped to actually compete with some of the higher priced titles, trying to encourage editorial boards to move from commercially published journals, launching educational campaigns to help inform our faculty. But the one thing, again, that we found out here was that a lot of the societies, again, and university presses did not have the wherewithal to absorb any of this move from these commercial vendors at the time. And Spark spent a lot of time trying to work with university presses, trying to work with societies, and I think finally determined that libraries might be one of the key partners in helping us to build infrastructure to create more capacity within the not-for-profit sector for publishing. And certainly a number of libraries early on saw the light. Certainly Stanford was very active in the early days in creating Highwire Press and trying to get lots of the scholarly, prestigious scholarly societies up and into the digital world. Project Muse with Hopkins and Hopkins Press, and certainly Project Euclid, which is the math and statistics from Cornell University. But it's also filtered out to many more of us who are beginning to come online with publishing programs. Again, some smaller in scope and some of those larger ones, although the Scholarly Publishing Office at Michigan just talked about 20 journals that they have now. And Penn State has a journals publishing operation. Office of Scholarly Communication and Publishing there at the bottom was from Wisconsin. These are just a couple of the CIC libraries who have developed publishing programs. But I think another important reason for libraries to be engaged in publishing is to really be able to work closely with faculty and be there to figure out what the emerging roles will be. The same technology that's changing the way we might publish might also be fundamentally changing what the products, how scholars do research, and what the outcomes and products of that will be. And again, we're seeing the huge amount of data sets that are arising out of social science and out of big science. The Sloan Digital Sky Survey that's generating lots and lots and lots of data. Certainly all the kinds of things that are going to happen in the translational research within the medical arena that's going to create lots and lots of patient and clinical data that will have to be integrated with research data. And the new genres in the humanities, and I think the humanities have kind of been slapped around today, but I think when you think about it, it seems to me that's where real change is coming and fundamentally how research is being put out there. And these whole electronic textual editions and thematic research collections where, you know, bringing all of these primary resources together in the electronic web is just creating a whole new genre that folks in the humanities are dealing with, and I think it's a very exciting development in thinking about where things may end up. So just very much in summary here, importance for libraries, I think, for being involved in this arena. One is simply staying relevant. Two, building infrastructure and skills, whether or not the future turns out to be what we're doing now. If we have people who are beginning to be familiar with the technology, begin to understand principles of publishing, are working with faculty in partnerships, I think we're building capacity that will help us be flexible and grow in the future. Again, building relationships with faculty is key. Educating about copyright and open access as we do these projects is critical. And whether or not we've heard actually in the last session that I went to, whether open access may or may not be appropriate in some instances for some of the content. And then assuring that issues of copyright access, findability, long-term preservation are addressed as new systems evolve. And again, unless we're at the table, unless we're really intimately involved, that's not always going to be the case. Again, I think it's important for libraries to be here. Mark Mattani was one of the first faculty members I met when I came on campus, and he was telling me about his journal and how at the end of the year the bill would come and they didn't have enough subscription revenue and he'd have to send invoices out to his editorial board members to pay the difference. And it seemed to me we ought to be able to do something to help minimize his costs so he could do what he needed to do. I haven't dared ask him if that's come true, and I'm afraid from the title of his talk it may not be, but at any rate, I will give you then Mark Mattani to talk about his experience with OJS.
Good afternoon. Are there any, other than Ed and myself, are there any other journal editors here? Oh, excellent. Okay. We're going to talk about our own experiences, and I suspect my experiences are significantly different than Ed's. I am the editor of Behavior and Social Issues, which is put out more or less by Behaviorists for Social Responsibility. Behavior and Social Issues is a peer-reviewed interdisciplinary journal. Most of our contributors are coming out of behavior analysis, which is itself an interdisciplinary field encompassing P pieces of psychology, education, social work, some medicine, and so forth. And the primary interest of the journal is in advancing the analysis of human social behavior through the natural science of behavior. Now, that's different than we think of, behavior analysts think of what they do as different than social science. They see it as a form of natural science that involves experimentation and manipulation of variables and so forth. I could talk about all day about that, but that's obviously not the heart of what the talk is today. But of particular relevance here is that what we're interested in the journal is applying the science of behavior, the science of behavior analysis, to issues that have social justice, human rights, and environmental dimensions in particular. From the very beginning, the journal has focused, and I'll talk about the beginning in a minute, on roughly looking for scientific support for progressive values. How can social, but particularly behavioral science, be used to support, for example, human rights? The journal started really sometime around 1980 as a newsletter that grew into a journal. This used to happen a fair amount in those days. There was a group called Behaviors for Social Action. They were mostly, I'm told, I was not part of the organization yet at that point, but they mostly saw the world through relatively Marxist kinds of lenses. The cover, when they started putting a cover on it, was red and so forth. They tried to manage the journal through the 80s purely by volunteers, purely by somebody keeping the extra copies out in the garage for inventory and so forth. And by about 2000, by about 1990, they couldn't figure out how to make it work. The demand on volunteers was too great, and there were fewer and fewer people, unfortunately, in the behavior analytic community who had a primary focus on the area that BFSA was focused in. In 1990, the Cambridge Center for Behavioral Studies took over the journal, changed its name. It used to be called Behavior and Social Action. Up through that point, it became Behavior and Social Issues in 1990. The Cambridge Center is associated with B.F. Skinner and with a number of other very well-known behavior scientists. Cambridge Center struggled along with it for about 10 years and never was able to make it a paying proposition. In 1999, they said, we're going to stop publication next year because we're losing too much money. Behaviorist for Social Action had since become Behaviorist for Social Responsibility. We said, give us this chance. We'll give it back to us. Give us the copyright. Give us everything. We'll start over. And we did. Costs have been an issue throughout. We're still about $3,500 a year in the hole. We started. It's been, obviously, it was a paper journal all the way through all of this and still is a paper journal. In about 2000, we just decided, the editorial board decided that we needed to go online, so I threw together some HTML and put up a website and put it up online and so forth, so we were just kind of limping along, but we were getting more exposure at least there. In 2005, Nancy actually approached me from the library and asked if we would like to be a test case, and I'd been kind of talking to people at the library for a couple of years before that, and they kept saying how wonderful it would be to have open access and to use these systems and so forth. And I said, sure, that's good. Now, where are we going to get, we need some help to do this, because we essentially were using all of our volunteer energy at that point. Now, we've been now using, as I said, we've been using OJS for 2 years, and we've had some struggles. I'll let Nancy talk about that. I know there were times when Nancy was really frustrated when on a Sunday morning I'd be sending her email after email saying, the journal is not up, the journal has disappeared, everyone who's looking for the journal is getting the message, file not found, error 404, and so forth. And so we, and particularly I think we're fairly demanding in terms of, you know, when I had it up on Earthlink, it was simple, but it was always there, and so it needed to be here. The library and the computer center We're extremely responsive, however, and all of those issues have been resolved and were typically resolved very quickly. I think it's probably harder with a very complex, large university system where we're operating through academic computing than it would be for a lot of other smaller systems. All right. The journal looks roughly like that. We clearly have enhanced visibility and impact, the number of visits, the number of downloads, the number of all of the statistics, basically in the last year has gone up by 120% from where it was a year ago. Now, that also was true the year before, so our exposure and potentially our impact is clearly growing, and there are a lot of reasons why that's happening, but certainly the enhanced interface, but the enhanced indexing and other things that we've been involved with are clearly helping. And the journal and the editorial board are very happy about that. It's a fine, high-quality online presence, good search capacities, and so forth. And most of you are working with this stuff, so I'm not telling you anything that's a big surprise there. It also, we hope, is advancing the possibility of going all online, which would certainly be a great help to me, and it would certainly be a great help to our folks, because at this point it's just more work to do the online version and the paper version. We're still doing the paper version. We're using a commercial printer who also does our subscription and fulfillment, but that's very expensive. Now, these are the questions that came up with our editorial board, and these are things that practically, and many of you, and I know from the discussions here at this meeting, and other things that we've talked about before, have heard these discussions multiple times. But when you're meeting with the editorial board and you're saying, I think we need to go open access, and I think this is why we should do it. Now, one of the things that's clear with our journal is open access is a social justice issue. And who has access to this information, particularly if we're dealing with really important issues related to poverty, to HIV, to psychiatric medications and their misuse and abuse, and a wide variety of other things, terrorism, nonviolent social action. It's really important that everybody who needs to can have access to that information, and it certainly wasn't happening with our little subscription kind of operation. But we did have editorial board members who were really scientific, but who also really had questions about whether this was appropriate even in a capitalist society, or whether we didn't need to in some way be part of this. Obviously, the Marxist kind of thread had attenuated some by this point. But we also had lots of discussions around financial and practical kinds of implications. Some folks felt, because we had commercial publishers, Sage was very interested, for example, in working with us, either taking over the journal or publishing it for us. We had a small publisher also very interested in doing these kinds of things. And some of the editorial board members felt like, well, given what they can offer, they can do marketing, they can do fulfillment, they can do all the editorial management, they can do the production work, but particularly the marketing, maybe we'll get much more exposure if we go commercial rather than if we go open access. And those were discussions that really are still ongoing on the editorial board, and luckily I have the loudest voice there, and we really have made a commitment. We put it, as soon as we made the commitment as a group, I put it in an editorial in the journal so that it was down in writing. But it still is a question, and these are things that editorial board members really did struggle with and continue to struggle with now. Something else that has come up with the board is royalties. And if we became a Sage journal, either the editor or the editorial board or the journal as a corporation would get royalties, for example. And now we don't get anything. And then they think, what more could we do with this? I have friends who edit commercial journals who do get royalties. They get a percentage of the take, essentially. Okay, concerns among board members and myself, in some cases, there are questions around sustainability. Our efforts so far are heavily dependent on individuals. The journal would be dead had I not picked it up in 2000, and the journal wouldn't be what it is now if we didn't have the people who are at the table here. And we happen to have a university librarian who, before she came to us, was heavily committed to open access. We happen to have someone who had been serving as acting university librarian, who became our digital librarian and so forth, who was very interested in doing this. It's not clear to me, it's not clear to the editorial board, that there's a clean way to institutionalize this and make sure that it goes on. If I got hit by a bus tomorrow, which is not impossible, it happened to my spouse last year, what would happen to the journal? It would probably stop publication, I'm relatively sure, even though we have a very involved editorial board. There's also questions in the minds of many of our editorial board members of, will universities continue to support this? And this is where that comes from. And it may not make the same sense to people from Canada as it might to people from the US. But our public universities are, of course, government-funded. Government in the US is heavily tied in with corporate interests. That's more and more true. When there are people like Elsevier who have lobbying efforts to try to limit open access and so forth, it's possible that those efforts are going to win and that at some point the librarians may feel, at least this is the concern of board members, librarians may feel this is really important, but we just can't afford to do it anymore. And those are things that board members look at and say, is this true for the long term? It's working for us right now. We do still have we'd love to go all electronic in our discipline. It's not yet clear that that's going to be regarded as a serious publication, even though we've been peer-reviewed for, 25-plus years now. When it goes online, there are a bunch of online newsletters that call themselves online journals in our discipline, and will we become one of those rather than one of the six essentially core journals within the discipline? And people on the board are worried about that. It's still not easy for some people. We heard this in a previous presentation. It's not easy for everybody to go to the interface of OJS and say, oh yeah, I can see what to do. It's a wonderful interface, but it's not a perfect interface, and some of my editorial board members have looked at what they'd have to do to do reviews online. They're not convinced they're going to remember how to do it, so we basically are still doing reviews by email, and then I upload everything and so forth. The final thing is, I think in terms of concerns, that for everybody who's involved in this effort so far, except maybe some of the library folks, this really turns out to be more work added to what they're already doing. And that's the concern around volunteer time. And obviously, this is all service for me. And if you're from academic settings, service doesn't count for much. But beyond whether it counts, the thing is that the time that I put into this, of course, I'm not putting into scholarship, and that's an issue. And the time I'm putting into this, I'm not putting into teaching. And so the easier we can make all of this to get moving and to clean up interfaces and so forth, the better in terms of people's productivity, and the easier, I think, to get people who are willing to volunteer. Behavior and Social Issues is very easy to find, behavioranddsocialissues.org. Thank you.
Good afternoon in steamy Vancouver. My name is Ed Velasquez, and I'm the founder and chief editor of First Monday. I'll talk to you a little bit about First Monday. First Monday is one of the first openly accessible peer-reviewed journals on the internet, solely dedicated to research about all aspects of the internet. Since its start in May of 1996, we've published 838 papers and 135 issues. An average monthly issue, and by the way, the title of the journal comes from our attempt to try to publish on the first Monday of every month. That often doesn't happen, but there you have it. An average monthly issue contains 6 research papers, plus on occasion book reviews, interviews, and editorials. Papers in First Monday have been written by over 1,000 different authors in over 30 different countries, representing a wide variety of institutions. In addition, we have published 8 special issues that have been dedicated to proceedings of different conferences, like this conference. We're going to publish the proceedings later this year of this conference, or they're sometimes focused on special topics. Some of the secret history of First Monday. First Monday was born in the summer of 1995 in a proposal that I wrote to the Danish publisher Munksgaard to start a new internet-only peer-reviewed journal about the internet. Munksgaard, at the time, it was an internationally renowned publisher of scientific and medical journals, and they agreed that they wanted to experiment with the internet. They didn't want to risk any of the journals that they were currently publishing, so starting a new journal would allow them to learn about the internet. So in September of 1995, they agreed, they gave me the green light to start the journal. So I began to organize an editorial board and a group of senior editors. Esther Dyson was the first person to join me as an editor. She was a consulting editor. She still is a consulting editor. And Rishabh Ghosh, who at the time was in New Delhi, he's now at Maastricht University in Holland, became international editor. We then put together an editorial board, and it included luminaries like Vince Cerf and Tony Durham, Ed Kroll, Bonnie Nardi, Ian Peter, and Rich Wiggins. We now have about 8 different editors, plus about 18 members of our editorial board, and we have a large group of readers and reviewers. In October 1995, Esther Dyson and I met with Anders Geirsten, who then was the vice president for journals of Munksgaard, and we met in Copenhagen to try to figure out how we might make this journal work. The name of the journal was chosen, First Monday. I had in my proposal an awful academic title for the journal, and so we picked First Monday as something a little bit jazzier and confusing, based on its planned frequency. Munksgaard's graphic designer came up with our very distinctive logo and interface for the journal, and Munksgaard owned a markup company in Copenhagen called Mondo Media, and they began to work with different kinds of experiments of how the journal would look. We were beginning to collect manuscripts. We had planned to have our first issue come out in January of 1996, but that was postponed because we didn't have a lot of really good papers. We wanted to wait so that the first issue would be a killer issue. So finally, by about March, we had a good group of papers, and we prepared the first issue. And it appeared at the 5th International World Wide Web Conference in Paris on the first Monday of May 1996, May 6th. At the conference, we gave out diskettes, those funny little plastic things they used to store stuff on. We gave out diskettes with the first issue, and we gave away, of course, T-shirts with the First Monday logo. And the server was accessible in a warehouse in the Copenhagen harbor. FirstMonday.dk was the address, and we sent out a lot of different press releases. The original publication model in 1996 was set up by Munksgaard, and the journal was freely accessible. We encouraged people to register and get a password, and if you did that, we would give you a CD that had the first volume of the issue in early 1997. So a few people did sign up for this. They paid 100 Danish kroner, which at the time was about $15, and they went along with this. In May of 1997, we had a meeting with Munksgaard. Esther, Rishabh, and I had a meeting with Munksgaard, and we talked about this, and we said we really should just get rid of the password and the registration. We should just make everything available, all the archives, none of this nonsense. And Munksgaard went along with that. So First Monday really became an openly accessible journal then. Of course, open access wasn't a term in common use at that point. If you look at the directory of open access journals at Lund University, I looked at this on Monday, and it lists something like 2,750 different open access scholarly journals. And First Monday, of course, is in this directory. In late 1998, Munksgaard decided to sell First Monday. And Esther and Rishab and I were getting a fee from Munksgaard to do our editorial work. And we told Munksgaard, well, you can keep the fee and we'll take the journal. And to our great surprise, they said yes. So I talked to the then director of the university libraries at UIC, Sharon Hogan, and said, Sharon, I'd like to move First Monday from Copenhagen to the University of Illinois at Chicago. And to again, to my surprise, Sharon agreed. So the contents of the server was moved from Copenhagen to Chicago, actually to several machines at UIC. And UIC continues to provide support to this day. We changed the domain name from firstmonday.dk to firstmonday.org, although, and we had pointers going from firstmonday.dk to firstmonday.org, although we do maintain servers with the firstmonday.dk address. So it allowed for a smooth transition for all of First Monday's readers. We've also had two First Monday conferences on our 5th and 10th anniversaries. The first conference, which took place on our 5th anniversary, occurred in Maastricht at the International Institute for Infonomics, and that conference was strongly supported by the European Commission and Maastricht University. Some 200 participants attended the event. We had speakers from Europe, the United States, and Indonesia. The second conference took place last year in Chicago at UIC. We had over 300 participants from over 30 countries, many from Africa, Asia, and South and Central America, as well as Europe. That conference was heavily supported by the MacArthur Foundation and the Open Society Institute, and we're quite grateful for their support. Well, who looks at First Monday? If you look at the logs for First Monday, we have readers that come to the journal from 182 different countries. Most of the readers, that is the people who read First Monday the most, the top 10 reading countries of First Monday, you see the list on the slide, the United States, the UK, Australia, Canada, Netherlands, Germany, Japan, Denmark, France, and Sweden. A lot of the traffic comes from the United States, as you might expect. A great deal of traffic also comes from Europe, but we do have lots of traffic coming from elsewhere around the world. We're quite happy about that. Here's a breakdown, again, of some of the higher domain names of where the traffic is coming from. Google, of course, pushes a lot of traffic. Google, we've done articles about Google, and Google is very nice to us, and they heavily rank us, they highly rank us, so we get a lot of traffic to First Monday from Google, so thank you, Google. What's interesting is, can I be more specific about First Monday's readers? Well, we made an early decision not to collect a lot of detailed information in our logs about our readers, but we certainly, I want to collect information in the logs about what people were reading, rather than where they were coming from. And so what I really find interesting is how important the archives of First Monday happened to be. That is, in any given year, most of the traffic to First Monday is not to the current issues, but to the archives. Now, I should be maybe depressed about that. Maybe I'm not doing a good job as an editor, that I don't have more lively content than the current issues. But it's, to me, making the archives available and seeing a lot of traffic to them is a good thing, and it certainly makes our contributors to First Monday very happy. So in 2006, for instance, the most read top 10 papers, none of those papers were published in 2006. And you can get some sense of that from looking at these statistics here. For example, in 1999, four of the top 10 papers were published in 1999, but that's not often the case. As the archives grow in First Monday with more and more papers, more and more issues, we'll see most of the traffic, I think, to the journal going to that. Well, these blips when we have some really popular article that will draw some traffic. Several contributors to First Monday have told me repeatedly that their papers to First Monday are the most read works of all their publications. One frequent contributor to First Monday, Clifford Lynch of CNI, has told me repeatedly that First Monday is not a journal, but it's a phenomenon. And his papers are consistently ranked as the most read papers in First Monday year after year. I don't have good data for the Munk's Guardian years of First Monday, those first 3 years. But since we've moved to UIC, you can see that the number of successful requests for pages has generally gone up over time from over a million in 1999 to over 6 million in 2006. So we're generating a lot of traffic, and we're quite happy about that. First Monday is going to change. We've made changes over the years to First Monday. In its original Munk's Guardian state, this is what it looked like. This is what the first issue looked like in May of 1996. It was, one might say, very Scandinavian, very clean, uncluttered. Some people were confused by it, but what is this? But that was the way First Monday appeared for a number of years. One of the classes that I teach is a class on internet publishing, and so I worked with a group of my graduate students in that class. I teach that class at Dominican University in the suburbs of Chicago, and some of my students have worked on various aspects of First Monday, and they pushed me to make some changes. And so we did come up with a new design. This was led by one of the students who's subsequently become the art editor for First Monday, Sue Bochinski, and where we essentially filled up that white space and put some teasers to get people interested in some of the content, either the current content or content in the archives. And we essentially have kept this design up to this month when we're moving to OJS. We're excited about moving to OJS. It's a big change for First Monday, but it's going to resolve a number of problems that have been created by the success of First Monday. It's going to certainly simplify the production of the monthly issues and the special issues of First Monday. It's certainly going to make more transparent the editorial and review processes, and that I'm very much looking forward to. It's certainly going to change the way First Monday appears. The real problem is the editorial work. Right now, I receive at least one paper a day for review on First Monday. Sometimes I receive six papers a day for review on First Monday. I don't get, in the first few years of First Monday, I used to get a lot of bad poetry. I don't get that anymore. I really get serious, high-quality papers. People look at First Monday, and they measure what they're going to send to us by what has been published. Right now, those manuscripts are all handled for review, and my handling of different editors and readers and reviewers is all handled with my email software, Eudora, and what's inside my head. So you can imagine the dangers of doing that. Correspondence falls by the wayside. I forget where a manuscript happens to be in the review process. A potential contributor, will send me very angry notes wondering what's going on. First Monday has prided itself on having a quick turnaround for manuscripts, but that has become slower and slower because our editorial processes have essentially become more and more constipated. And so I see with OJS a way of getting around some of these problems, of making it much more transparent and making my ability to communicate with editors and readers and reviewers much easier. So we're going to get rid of some of the black box aspects of our editorial process, and that I'm looking forward to. One of the things that, one of the production fantasies that Esther Rishab and I had under the Munksgaard regime, and I should say this about it was a good thing that we bought First Monday from Munksgaard. Shortly after we bought First Monday from Munksgaard, Munksgaard was sold to Blackwell. And then last year, Blackwell was sold to Wiley. In those changes, I have no idea what would have happened to First Monday. One of the fantasies we had back in the early days of First Monday was to have a continuous publication model. In that model, we would publish papers. So, for instance, this month, the July issue closed. So between now, so July 2nd, the first Monday of July, the July issue closed. So between July 2nd and August 6th, every paper that had gone through the editorial process and been reviewed would essentially go into the August issue and would appear in print in the August issue. Then August 6th, the first Monday of August, the August issue would close. Whether it had six papers or 60 papers, it would close, and we'd start accumulating the content for the September issue. We really want to do that sort of continuous publication model because we have so many good papers that are awaiting publication, and we think with OJS we'll be able to do that. Certainly, we're experimenting with other ways of making content available on First Monday. Several of my former students are creating podcasts, and the first podcast interviews of First Monday authors will occur in August. We're looking at making translations of First Monday content more available. That has been happening sort of on a random basis. People contact us asking about, well, I want to translate that paper into Hungarian. And so that's happened randomly. We want to make that more systematic. Because First Monday has no income, we don't even have a bank account. We really are dependent on a variety of volunteers, individuals to help us with editorial work, locating manuscripts, getting prospective works ready, doing the editorial work, the markup work. We've been fortunate to have great support since 1999 from UIC in providing servers, excellent creative technical support, and excellent bandwidth. First Monday's future is largely in the hands of our supporters, and each of them owns their own little part of this journal. So I'm quite optimistic with OJS about the growth of the journal in the future as one of the most important open access journals on the internet about the internet. Thank you very much.